In the matter of State versus BCS, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Stephen Hunter, Deputy Public Defender on behalf of BCS.
May it please the court, Alexis Ager, Burlington County Assistant Prosecutor on behalf of the state.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Deputy Attorney General Valeria Dominguez on behalf of the Attorney General as amicus curiae.
Good afternoon, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Hunter, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Radler and Associate Justices. I'd ask to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
We'll have you back, hopefully for a little less. Go ahead.
Good. That sounds good. Thank you. There are two primary issues before the court today. First, after applying a searching and critical review of the record, was the trial judge clearly mistaken in finding that the statements by Bonnie during the consensual intercept, quote, did not constitute a threat that would overbear the will of the defendant to make a confession, unquote. The judge described Bonnie's statements during the intercept as, quote, vague insinuations, unquote. An example of one of the threats, though, is as follows, quote, stop making effing excuses. I want the truth. My kids are devastated. Wait till Joe finds out. Joe is going to wind up being in jail for beating you up, and then I'm not going to have my freaking husband around to help me take care of my effing kids when I'm at work. I want the truth. That's all I want, unquote. The record clearly demonstrates that the threats by Bonnie were not vague insinuations. Rather, they were clear and specific threats that unless the defendant confessed, her husband Joe would beat up the defendant so badly that Joe would have to go to jail. These threats were repeated throughout the intercept and escalated until the defendant finally started to confess. Whenever the defendant began to waver and assert his innocence, Bonnie responded with the threat of her husband's physical violence. At trial, Bonnie testified that she could never tell her husband all the details about the incident because, quote, he would have been in jail, unquote. In fact, even several years after the intercept, Bonnie stated that, quote, Joe still doesn't know the truth to this day, unquote. She spoke about how it was well known, including by defendant, that her husband had a temper and was bipolar. And she confirmed, which is plainly obvious in the transcript of the intercept, that she purposely threatened defendant because she did not believe he was telling the truth about being innocent. On this record, there is simply no way that the state can meet its burden to prove that the confession during the intercept was secured voluntarily by means consistent with this court's constitutional jurisprudence. The next issue is whether the state has established that the second confession during police custody is admissible because it is sufficiently attenuated from the first confession. The judge below relied on the time between the confessions and the fact that the defendant came to the police station. However, there are other attenuation factors that strongly favor suppression. First, there was no intervening circumstances, such as a new arrest or defendant learning about new evidence that led him to confess. Second, the police initiated the second confession. Third, the effect of the first confession was clear, as the record here shows that the defendant was aware that Bonnie had spoken to the police, and therefore the cat was out of the bag. Fourth, the flagrancy of the police misconduct. The police participated here and ended up profiting from Bonnie's illegal threats during an intercept. As the police were supervising the intercept, they should have stopped it when Bonnie started threatening defendant. Bonnie's actions were arguably probable cause for an arrest under criminal coercion, NJSA 2C13-5. At the beginning of the second confession, the police also specifically referenced the first confession to Bonnie as a reason for a defendant to confess to them. And then finally, the second confession is essentially a continuation of the first confession, as the police picked up on the theme of defendant getting help, which is right where Bonnie left off. In other words, the confessions are closely interconnected. For all these reasons, I ask that the order denying suppression be reversed, judgment conviction be reversed, and the matter remanded for a new trial. Thank you. That's my opening statement. If there's any questions from the court, I'd be happy to take them.
Mr. Hunter, can you clarify something for us? Was there a motion to suppress the consensual intercept? And if not, does that matter? What effect does it have?
There was a motion, Your Honors. It was, and the judge ruled on it. It was just that the parties didn't, they submitted their arguments based on the briefs. They didn't have a hearing about it. And that's...
Where is that in the record? I was looking for it also, Mr. Hunter. I could not find it.
Sure. It's, well, it's the judge's decision. It's in the transcripts. I know they talked about how they submitted on it, and the judge rules on the on this issue. And the judge talks about how in we didn't file the party's briefs in the because you don't file you know
they're not briefs. Part of the record,
right? They're not in the appellate record, but in the judge's opinion, he talks about how the parties submitted on the record, and he made his ruling. He made his ruling based on his reading of the transcripts. So the stuff that I'm that I quoted is specifically the judge's ruling on his findings about whether these statements constituted a threat or not.
Can I just, Mr. Hunter, not to dwell too much on this, but I'm looking at the written decision of the court, page 16A, and under legal analysis, the court says, the issue before the court is whether defendant made a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of his right to remain silent when he gave a taped statement to detectives. And goes right, right. into the advice, yes, given about
right.
his he Miranda was, warnings.
They, right. If you read his, hold on, let me pull it up. So, it's in, I know I have the state's brief right in front of me, which is quoting from 18A and 19A of the transcript, where the judge made his rulings about the consensual interstep, where
he certainly talks about it, but I didn't see a motion to suppress that statement.
Mr. Hunter, maybe you can clarify this for us, if not later in the argument on rebuttal, then afterward, and
sure,
tell us where
I mean,
we can.
There was never any issue. I mean, in the appellate, it was clear that the defendant was trying to get his statement suppressed, and that he was arguing that he was coerced, and that the judge ruled on it. The problem, quite frankly, Your Honors, was that they didn't have a hearing. They should have had a hearing where Bonnie testified as part of this, but for some reason the
counsel,
parties...
Counsel, part of the decision is that the parties waived oral argument on the motion.
Right. No,
so
I know they did.
You're saying they should have had a hearing, but they even waived oral argument, let alone a hearing. They submitted
right.
on the papers.
No, so. I know. I agree, Your Honor. That's what I'm saying, that they submitted on the papers. But
so the appellate division at page 34 says it's not clear whether the defendant filed a motion to suppress the recording of the telephone intercept. So all we're asking is if you could clarify that for us.
Sure. I don't have the papers right in front of me from
not this moment,
but I can tell you that looking back, that I mean Alexis was there in Burlington. This was part of the argument, and that's why the judge ruled on it. The judge didn't. You know, he didn't rule on it for no reason. It's because they were making the argument in the paper
the judge only ruled on the police interrogation. He never ruled on the consensual intercept at any point. I read the decision, and there's nothing about a consensual intercept anywhere in that decision.
Could you point out to me, because
I have it right here where I'm mistaken. Could you point page
sure.
numbers? I have them all right here.
Sure, it's if you look at D18A and D19A, it's quoted, an easier way to find it is quoted in the Burlington County Prosecutor's brief on page 22.
I'm looking at the court's decision of May 12, 2015 on the motion to suppress, and there's nothing in there about the consensual intercept. It's all about
right,
the police state. Is there a separate opinion that I didn't see?
I believe so, Your Honor. And it's if we look at page 22 of the state's brief, it's quoted right there.
I don't care what the state's brief quotes. I'd like to know where it is on the judge's decision itself. Because I don't see it.
Mr. Hunter, I'm giving you a life raft here. I think you want to take it. Clarify for us afterward when you have a chance to do so. And we'll happily take a letter after the argument. The conclusion, concluding paragraph of the opinion that Justice Fernandez-Vina was referring to says the motion to suppress the statement, the videotape statement of the police is denied. That's the judge's ruling, and that's at 19A. But we'll give you time because we simply want you to point us to it, and it's not going to be productive to continue that now. So let's go on with your argument.
And quite frankly, this record is pretty confusing. There was lots of motions, so I understand why there's a confusion on this issue. But anyway, if we just go back now to the substantive issue, which is, were these statements, threat, or were they vague insinuations, as the judge said in his opinion? And I think the judge is clearly wrong, and that there's no way, as we read these statements. Now, I only quoted one of the statements, but if you go through, you can see how they escalate, and it's just the opposite of vague insinuations. It's totally clear what's going on here. So,
Mr. Hunter, at the end of the conversation, though, BH, after promising him that she's not going to say anything to anyone else, indicates she's going to tell her husband, and the defendant indicates he's not going to have continued contact with the family, but he seems unfazed that she's going to tell her husband. There's no indication in the way that conversation closes out that he was demonstrating any sort of feeling of threat that you're describing.
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. There's a part where he actually says specifically, don't tell, you're not going to tell the husband.
It doesn't end that way.
They say it. There's a part in there where he does say that. I don't want to have to search through the record here in front of me as we're on the video. But I can tell you that my recollection is there's a part toward the end where a defendant specifically says, he mentions the husband. He says, and don't tell him. And also, it's clear.
I'd like you to give me that page citation, because at the end of the conversation in the transcript that I read, he indicates acquiescence that she's going to tell her husband. And he is not concerned about it.
Well, okay. I'm
looking at 88. Maybe I can help you. I'm looking at 88A. Which is towards the end, and I'm quoting, this is defendant, I don't want Joe to know about this.
Right.
B, all right, I apologize to your kids, I'll get the help as long as it stays between us and no one has to know about it. And she says, that's fine, is that agreeable? And then on the next page, she says, I will keep my promise to you.
Right. That's the
is that what you're relying on?
That's what I'm relying on, Justice Alito.
So, our review is on the totality of the circumstances, correct?
Correct.
So, you've mentioned the threats. Do we take into consideration the lies as well?
Right.
Do we also take into consideration that, at least according to the colloquy, it's suggesting that she will ruin him by going to the police and making these claims that he's claimed that he's not guilty of.
Right. I agree. All those things are a factor, but the thing that stands out, which is as blatant, is the threats. Because you can see how they escalate, and then the threat is right when that's when he first turns to confess, is after that last threat that I read in my opening statement. And then after that, as we go through it, every time he starts to sort of waver and claim he's innocent, she immediately goes back to the threat. So, I mean, the threats are pervasive throughout this.
She never suggests in that long conversation that if you just confess, I'm not going to tell him, I'm not going to, I will just back off and you won't get hurt. I mean, he has to be aware that confessing is something that is going to potentially put him at greater peril if indeed he perceives peril. And I don't see a lot of alarm in his part of that conversation.
I respectfully completely disagree with that, Justice Patterson. The statements that Justice Alvin just read were exactly what I'm saying, that the agreement at the end was she's not going to tell anyone, and specifically the husband, that's who they talk about. So,
well, I'm looking at page 83 to 84. He just indicated he put his penis and what he did to the little boy. And at the bottom of 83, he says, Bonnie says, what shall I tell Joe? And he says, I don't know, that's between you and Joe, but I just want this to stay between us. I'll move on the way you want me to move on and lose contact if that's what you want. And then
right.
she continues with the questioning.
Right, but there's the
so
other
she's
section.
She's indicating
though,
she's going to tell him what whether he wants
right,
that or not.
There's another section, though, where he makes it clear that he doesn't want her to tell.
But he had already stated it. I look at the page that Justice Albin talked about. What I don't understand, Mr. Hunter, is where we're going with this. I mean, does the state in this consensual intercept have to have Bonnie give him warnings in order to have this conversation with him? Or otherwise, the subsequent warned statement is inadmissible and may not be used by the state?
No, this case is not about warnings, Your Honor. It's just about whether these statements are voluntary. So, and under this court's jurisprudence, State versus Kelly, that analysis applies even to private actors. So it's as Justice Altman said, it's the totality of circumstances. Was these statements a product of coercion? And,
so is it coercion when she tells him, honestly, the father of these children is going to be angry when he hears about this?
It's coercion
is
when...
Is that factual statement a coercive statement?
Well, the problem is it goes way beyond that. It says, my husband is going to beat you up and go to jail if you don't tell me the truth. I mean, that's a specific and direct threat to confess, or I'm going to go to the husband and tell them what the kids are saying, and he's going to come and beat you up. I mean, that is the threat. And that's the threat that's repeated throughout the transcript. And that's what switches him over to confessing.
So I just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing. Are you referring to the passage on 60A, he's going to flip and he's going to come after you, or are you referring to something else? Because you're using more loaded language than that.
Right. She starts off by saying he's going to flip, and that's why I was saying that it escalates. Because then he goes into exactly what I quoted before at the beginning of my statement, that wait till Joe finds out. Joe is going to wind up being in jail for beating you up. I mean,
none of that is, if you don't say anything, this is all going to happen. She's expressing the fact that it's certainly strong indication that she is going to tell her husband what the children's allegations are.
She's telling that. She's saying that, though, in response. Here's the beginning part of it. Stop making effing excuses. I want the truth. That's because he's saying he's innocent. And then she says,
Is that a threat? There's no threat there. Just said, stop making effing excuses. Not a threat.
Keep on reading.
The threat is, wait till Joe finds out. Joe is going to wind up being in jail for beating you up. And then I'm going to have and then he's saying how her husband's going to be in jail.
The father of the children is going to find out. That's a statement of fact. That's not, if you don't tell me in the next 5 minutes what happened here, I'm going to tell him. She is telling him he's going to find out. He's the father of the children.
Yeah. No, what you're saying is she's waving that as a basically offering, I'm not going to tell him about this if you tell the truth. When he keeps on denying it, that's when she says that. And she says it more than once, as you said. It's in the transcript.
It's blatantly clear in the transcript that she's threatening him with telling Joe about everything unless the defendant admits.
Where is the police officer when all of this is being said?
He's listening on the. He's sitting right there with the mom, listening on the call. So I mean, that's what I'm saying, that the police have bear some responsibility here, because they instructed her on what to do. This. She admitted at trial, by the way, that she knew what the police told her to do, but she had her own ideas of how she was going to conduct this. And remember, there's testimony at trial. She talks about she saw movies where people were interrogated, and that's where she got this idea of going, you know, basically threatening him.
What is the state's burden in terms of proving voluntariness? Is it beyond a reasonable doubt?
I guess I believe so, Your Honor. So, I mean, that's the whole point here. What I'm saying is that on this record, there's no way that the state can prove that this was a voluntary confession, because there's direct, specific threats that are repeated throughout the transcript and they escalate. And then there's this promise that, okay, I'm not going to say anything if you tell the truth to me now. And at trial, she says about how she repeats it again. She says that I could never tell Joe because Joe would go to jail for beating up the defendant. And she talks about why, you know, that she specifically did it on purpose because she didn't think that the client was telling the truth and she was trying to get him to confess. I mean, it's very similar to Fulminante, the U.S. Supreme Court case, where you use the threat of physical violence and a promise to basically not have that physical violence happen.
Well, Fulminante took place inside a custodial setting. This individual was not in a custodial setting, was he?
No, but Your Honor, my opinion, that's a distinction without a difference. A threat can happen anywhere. I mean, you can call someone on the phone and threaten them. It doesn't really matter. That's really just not relevant. It doesn't matter that it was in the prison.
But the facts in Fulminante that you're saying are similar to this are dramatically different. This individual, your client, was texting this woman when she called him back. She didn't initiate this conversation. He did.
Okay, right, but but the whole point about this is that that she was trying to get a confession, just like the informant in Fulminante, and she resorted to using threats of physical violence to secure that. And
Fulminante was in a prison. That man, your client, was seated at home in a telephone conversation with this with BH.
Right. Well, respectfully, Your Honor, threats don't have to be immediate. I mean, the threat can. It's just because it's not going to happen that doesn't mean it's any less of a threat. I mean, you can threaten someone by saying this is going to happen in the future, and that still could be a very scary and valid threat.
I'm just questioning the analogy to Fulminante, Mr. Hunter. That's why I'm pressing
just
these
so
points.
I can clarify. I'm sorry. Just so I can clarify what the threat is. Your argument is that she is threatening him that if you don't confess, he's going to beat you up. Joe's going to beat you up. Not that if this happened to my child or my children, Joe's going to find out and beat you up. You're arguing it's the former, right, not the latter.
Exactly.
And
right.
What do you base that on?
I base it on the plain language of the consensual intercept transcript, which I quoted in my brief that I read before the court. I think it's plainly obvious.
I know you're quoting it. He's going to find out. He's going to go off. He's going to beat you up. Find out says find out the kids were molested. Find out doesn't mean find out you didn't confess. So tell me what you're relying on to conclude the former. It makes is what shows the threat of force, not that if he probably, like most other fathers, found out somebody was molesting their children, they might go off.
Right.
What language are you basing that on? Because I can tell you, I read it. I didn't get that sense that you're – I mean, I've seen a number of these. Didn't get the sense that she was doing anything but saying – you molested our kids, he's not going to be happy. He's going to be angry, he's going to be violent, he's going to be whatever.
Okay, well, the point is, though, she coupled it with specific language, which Justice Alvin cited earlier, saying I'm not
I heard gonna... his language, too. I actually read it once.
Right. And she talked about it at trial, too, by the way. She said, I could never...
How about 67? We haven't spoken about 67A. Which is earlier than what you're quoting. And this is the mother. And since you're not telling me, Brian, I'm going to have to tell Joe about the evidence. And when Joe finds out about the evidence, he's going to come for you. And I'm not going to be able to stop him this time. And the bad part is he's going to go to jail for you. And then my kids are going to be devastated again. Right. I mean, that's another instance. There are other ones.
I know it's another instance, Justice Albin found. I'm asking you because I read that, and I didn't interpret it the way Justice Albin said. And I didn't interpret it the way you're arguing it. Is that what you're relying on to reach your conclusion?
Right. I'm relying on all the statements that were made talking about Joe in the husband.
Okay.
In the,
all right.
And I quoted them all in a row in my brief, actually.
I think they're absolutely clear.
Like, I don't understand. It doesn't seem to me any other interpretation as except that she was clearly threatening
Let's assume the same conclusion is reached. What part did the police play in those representations by Bonnie?
Well, they engaged her to do this, and they
in her representations, what part did they play in that? Because I thought she said she went beyond anything they told her.
Oh, yeah, right.
They didn't tell her what to say.
Right. I'm not saying that the officers instructed her to do this or anything like that. But what I'm saying is, though, that they had a responsibility as when this was happening, which they were direct, they were supervising her while she was doing it. She was at their office, that she's right there with them, that they should have stopped it. But, they, you know, the police have a duty to protect everybody. And as I said, I believe this is probable cause for criminal coercion. It's actually a crime that's happening that Bonnie is doing. It's like extortion. You're extorting someone to do something. Criminal coercion just means that you're doing it not for money or for goods. You're just doing that. You're extorting someone to get something. And that's exactly what Bonnie was doing. She was threatening him with physical violence to get him to confess. And that's a crime, actually.
Well, he first said he told, and he told the detectives he confessed because he was offered $5,000. That was his first explanation.
Right. Well,
then before the trial court, he said it was his usual agreeableness and conflict avoidance that led him to go along. And now we have the third iteration of the reason, which is fear of J.H. So which one is it?
After the confession came out the second time, he started saying all kinds of things, and including at trial. But that's not, you know, that's part of the whole cat out of the bag idea, too, that once the story is out there, the defendant is desperate, and he'll say lots of different things. But I'm not basing anything. I'm basing on the plain...
There was criminal activity here. I mean, you made a very strong statement.
I'm talking about just reading the transcript of the consensual intercept. To me, it jumps off the page, and that it's pretty outrageous, quite frankly, what was happening, and that for the judge to call it a vague insinuation is just not supported by it at all.
Mr. Hunter, what weight, if any, do we give to that portion of the second interrogation when there's no questioning and the defendant is left alone and the tape is running and he's talking to himself and he says, then I'm only saying these things because you have Bonnie told me to.
Right. Again, these are after the defendant made the confessions, they say all kinds of things afterwards. And it really is of no moment the focus should be what happened in the beginning that led to the confession. That's what happened at the consensual intercept is not affected by what happened later on. I'm talking about Bonnie's conduct. I'm talking about what the police did and how we got to that first, the consensual intercept confession, and then how that led into the second confession for the police. Everything after that, quite frankly, doesn't really matter. And again, the second point really is, you know, the fruit of the poisonous tree, the cat out of the bag. And I think this case, the state tries, and the judge below made a big deal about the time. But the real thing here is that there was no intervening circumstances. There was nothing. The case that the state relies on, State versus Fawcett, it's a Appellate Division case. In that case, between the two confessions, the police got new evidence from the defendant's girlfriend about him being involved in a crime and confronted the defendant with that at the second confession. So the Appellate Division and the trial judge said, the link was broken because of this new evidence that led to the confession. And the other big thing
Mr.
to remember.
Hunter,
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Your argument, if I understand it, really rests on the strength of problems or not with the first statement, because when you get to the second statement, the officers come right in and say, look, you made peace with her yesterday, now you need to make right with us. I'm paraphrasing. So
right.
If there's a problem with the first, your position is it carries over to the second. Is there
right.
anything in the nature of what the police do during the second interview, putting that comment aside, that you would argue overbore the defendant's will?
Well, they came close under LH, I believe, but I think that it was okay. But they used his need, his expressed desire for help that they learned about from the first confession, and they just continue that on and use that at the beginning of the second confession. But again, see, the whole point of the cat out of the bag doctrine is not that he's still being coerced the second confession. It's that the defendant knows that the cat's out of the bag, that Bonnie talked to the police. So he knows now basically the jig is up, that things. So that's
right.
So it's not really that he was coerced in the second time. It's just that he
different
now
question.
Knows
the thing. Different question. Is there anything in the second statement, aside from the references to what occurred before, that you're challenging in the police conduct?
No. It's all about the
first
threats.
Statement.
The first statement, and that how they, and then basically that statement should have been inadmissible, and that it was not attenuated, that the second statement is too interconnected to the first one. So that second one should be suppressed as well.
Questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Hunter?
No, I think I'd save my time for rebuttal. I'll try to find the statement if I can, but I probably would need to respond, Chief, to it in a letter if you prefer.
That makes sense.
You.
Focus on the other arguments. Don't worry about the motion right now.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Ager.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. Your Honor, the state would argue that the trial court judge and the appellate division properly affirmed the admission of the consensual intercept and the defendant's Mirandi statement to the police that happened the second day. Taking into account defendant's arguments, there is still no real evidence that the defendant's will was substantial, that the defendant's will was overborne by the during the consensual intercept, and that carried over the next day to his confession. The defendant was familiar with BH. They had a long familiar relationship, and the phone call was in fact initiated by defendant because he was in fact engaging in text messages and phone calls while BH was at the Burlington County Prosecutor's Office with her children. So after that, when the defendant and BH began to talk, it was a phone conversation that took place as family members. BH was not acting as an agent of the state at the time. She was a private citizen, and case law supports that even though private citizens, while wearing a wire or using consensual intercepts, are still private actors at that time. So the state would argue that the defendant's will was not overborne and that his consensual intercept was properly admitted, that and that the confession the next day was also properly admitted and was not a product of the consensual intercept from the previous day.
Can you tell us what are the limits that apply to a private actor in terms of threats they can or cannot make in this situation?
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that Judge Haynes properly characterized these as vague insinuations and not threats. So there was no immediacy in this case, as there was, say, in Fulminante, where the defendant was in prison with the people who were, and was already starting to receive, as they said in the opinion, tough treatment from the other prisoners based on the rumors of his involvement in his stepdaughter's murder. Here, the defendant was on the phone with BH. He was in his own apartment, and he was able to disconnect the call if he felt threatened. He was able to just hang up or just never talk to BH. But instead, this conversation continued, and it wasn't the threats directly, it wasn't the vague insinuations that led to the confession. It was when BH told him that she would keep everything between them and not go to the police. If you look at the consensual intercept, the defendant is greatly concerned during the entire conversation with what's going to happen to his life, what's going to happen to him. And when BH finally promised that she would not go to the police in his life, as he put it, he kept asking what was going to happen to his job, his apartment, his son. And when she said that she would keep it between them, that's when the confession started. It was not the discussion about what would happen with her husband, but it was more of a, I promise I'll keep this between us. And there's
We look at the totality of the circumstances, and part of that totality included the passages that we discussed earlier. I found the one that I was looking for in 73A. Joe is going to wind up being in jail for beating you up, and then I'm going to not have my friggin' husband around. Does that cross the line of what a private actor can say?
Your Honor, I would argue that that was not a threat, that she was not saying, if you don't tell me, I'm going to tell Joe, and then I'm going to have Joe specifically beat you up. I think it's more predictive behavior, what's going to happen when Joe finds out. This is the woman's husband, the father of the children, and so it's more predictive behavior and explanation. But
so is 67A, following up with the Chief Justice, I'm just going to read it. And you tell me whether or not this is predictive and whether or not this is just insinuating. And since you're not telling me, Brian, I'm going to have to tell Joe about the evidence. And when Joe finds out about the evidence, he's going to come for you. And I'm not going to be able to stop him this time. And the bad part is he's going to go to jail. Is that an insinuation? Is that vague? Is there not a connection between his not telling and the threat?
I would argue, Your Honor, that when you look at the rest of the statements between the defendant and BH, that he doesn't confess at that time, that he doesn't take it as a threat. The conversation continues between the two of them. So I would argue that he did not see it as threatening behavior. And when you look to the totality of the circumstances,
objectively, forget about how he took it. How would a reasonable person take it? Forget, would a reasonable person not think that that's a threat?
I think you have to look at the people who are involved in this matter, Your Honor. And these are two people who know.
Don't you think a police officer is sitting next to her at point 67A? Shouldn't the police officer have slipped her a little note saying, don't threaten him physically, don't threaten to harm him? Don't you think the police officer who's shoulder to shoulder with her and listening in should be somehow advising her not to be using these techniques?
Your Honor, when you look at the whole trial, including the trial transcript, and you have BH's testimony at trial, she stated quite clearly that the detectives attempted to guide her conversation and she ignored them. She waved them away, stating she was in her zone at the time of the consensual intercept and that she had her own ideas. So what the detectives did or did not do, it's were quite clearly ignored by BH during the conversation.
So we're trying to assess whether this is a threat for the moment. Assume that the comment on page 67A that Justice Alvin just read to you had been made by an officer in the later statement. Would you agree that was threatening / coercive commentary that shouldn't have been made, or would you consider it predictive?
I think it hinges upon the person making the threat, Your Honor. In this, in a case of a police officer making a statement like that, you have the authority behind the police figure that you don't have with a private citizen. I'm not conceding that it would be a threat, but what I am saying is that it hinges upon the circumstances. And instead, what you have is a brother-in-law and sister-in-law in this case, without the authority of law enforcement behind them. And that it's an entirely different set of circumstances when you add that authority.
There's another element to this conversation, or parts of this conversation as well, isn't there? And that is that she is trying to convey to him how incredibly serious the children's allegations are, and she does that in a couple of ways. She talks about some graphic reference. She has a graphic reference to lubricants, and what I view that is as an attempt to jar him into realizing the evidence that is there. And she is also trying to convey how upset she is. And it seems to me, tell me if you agree with this, it seems to me that a lot of the references to Joe are connected with the level of alarm that she is trying to convey to him, that has been caused by these very serious allegations of sexual abuse of children. And how does that, if fit into the totality of the circumstances of this conversation?
I would agree with that characterization, Your Honor. When you look at many of the references to Joe, it's not in conjunction with what do I tell Joe? What do I say to my husband about these charges? It's not, several of the references are not in any conjunction of what will happen when Joe finds out, but what do I tell my husband about these charges? So I think when you look at the totality of the circumstances, and there's an argument that this is an upset mother who's facing a very serious crisis with her children and wants to get help for her children. But also the references to what do I tell Joe would be what anyone would ask. What do you tell your partner about these charges? So I think when you look at the totality of the circumstances, many of the references to Joe are just benign. What do I tell my husband in regard to these charges?
I don't see that, with all due respect, counsel. We've given you two examples. I'm going back now to 63A. I want the truth. If I tell Joe, and then ... Joe is going to flip out. Those are three that I can see offhand. And it's always, if you don't tell me the truth, I am going to tell Joe. And Joe is going to beat you up, and Joe's going to go to jail. I mean, this is what she's conveying. And you're saying that is not a threat.
I would agree with Judge Haynes' characterization that it's a vague insinuation and not a threat, Your Honor, that this was not something that had the ability to overbear his will to give a full confession, let alone a confession the second day after a 15-hour break between the taped statement with Bonnie or the consensual intercept with BH and the taped statement with the detectives the next day.
The children had already been seen or just been seen by doctors. Isn't that correct? On page 60, a little higher up on the page, the exchange actually begins with the kids just, I'm going to say, saw the doctors. I had them examined. They're telling me that it's true. It did happen. And then she refers to Joe finding out that I got the results back from the doctors. He's going to flip. He's going to come after you. There does seem to be this back and forth between reference to the information and evidence that came out of the doctor examination, which took place already and arguably would have to be made known to the father of the children, and her continued conversation with the defendant.
I'm sorry.
Well, it just seems to me there seem to be going back and forth between referencing vaguely what it is we're talking about, the charges, the evidence, so forth. But it seems to all relate to one set of information. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, but just to correct the record, I think that the children had not at that point seen a doctor, that the visit to NJ Cares followed the interviews at the police or at the Child Advocacy Center in Burlington County. So the there was reference to it in the trial transcript that BH was told she could use deception, and she decided that's where she got the information about DNA evidence when there was
reference. Well, I know the DNA evidence, but I thought that the children had actually already been interviewed.
I believe if I remember the timeline correctly, I believe by the point of the interviews, she had not taken the children yet to the NJ Cares Institute that visit followed the.
But they had been interviewed by the Burlington County detectives. Wasn't it during those interviews that the defendant was continuously texting BH?
Yes.
And that at the conclusion of all those interviews, that's when the consensual recording was done, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. She had taken the children to the Child Advocacy Center to do the interviews after being contacted by DCCP, and then she was during that time, as Your Honor pointed out, the defendant was constantly texting her and calling her, and that led to the consensual intercept.
Because he was aware that these interviews were taking place, that something was going on, correct?
No, he was not aware that the interviews were going on, but he had an indication that Dyfus at the time, was involved in the investigation, because especially at the first page of the intercept, he was very upset, and one of his first statements is, "I swear, BH, me and Abby have nothing going on." So he is aware that there are allegations out there at that point that involve him and involve her children.
But this wasn't Dyfus's first involvement with his family, though, was it?
No, Your Honor.
Other
Just so I can be clear, I know it was raised before, but when did he first... He used other reasons for saying what he said, the money, and when did he first raise the fear of Joe as a reason for his confession? Procedurally,
it would have been during his when he filed the motion to suppress. I believe there was a mention in the defendant's brief about. Actually, I'm unsure at this point. It was raised at trial, for sure, that he was wary of JH. But it was not raised during any of these that the judge would have had before him when he was reviewing the transcript, and audio recordings and video recordings as well.
In other words, he didn't have it when the motion to suppress was filed and decided upon?
I believe when the motion to suppress was filed, his references were to BH's, as he characterized them, BH's threats. But there was the physical intimidation factor, I don't recall from looking at the defendant's brief.
Ms. Ager, can you clarify the question we'd asked Mr. Hunter earlier? Was the initial motion to suppress focused solely on the statement to the police or on the intercept as well?
I looked at it briefly this morning, Your Honor, and if I recall correctly, what it was focusing on was whether or not the consensual intercept induced him to confess the next day. So it was mentioned in the context of an inducement to confess during his tape statement with the detectives. But I don't recall if it was specifically the motion, but it was specifically to suppress the consensual intercept as well. I would have to supplement the record, Your Honor, in that regard.
Okay.
because the defendant's statement to BH was the day before, the state would also argue that there was no inducement from the statement to, from the defendant's conversation with BH to, that led to his confession the next day. There was a 15-hour break between the two statements. The defendant was, the defendant was in his own home, drove to the station freely, was in the lobby, and in this case, Your Honor, the state would point to the appellate division's opinion in State versus Fawcett, where the defendant had a slight break in custody as well, where he had been in custody up until about 2:30 a.m., and then the next day the detectives returned for more questioning with him, and that was a, that was enough of a break as he was home. He was sitting in the back of his, of the police car in that case.
Counsel, let's not focus just on the time, where I understand the argument you're presenting. Here you have the officers say, I'm looking at 105A, if you made your peace with Bonnie yesterday, I did, then you need to talk to us today. Doesn't that resolve the attenuation argument?
No, Your Honor, I would point to, the defendant was the one who raised, on page 104A, the defendant was the one who raised the phone call with Bonnie. He said, we've both spoken, I've talked to Bonnie, and I told her, look, I'll go to a counselor, I'll do what I have to do to get help to continue my life the way I need to continue my life with. So he raises the issue of BH during that conversation. He initiated it there in that regard. And the
What weight are we to give when the officers direct him in plain language, you need to talk to us today because of what you did yesterday?
I would argue, Your Honor, that it was not significant and did not overbear the will of the defendant in this matter.
No. How does it affect the attenuation argument is the question, not whether it, standing on its own, overbore the defendant's will.
No, I would, Your Honor, I would still argue that the 15-hour break was enough of an attenuation to form a break between the two conversations, and that the detective statements were off of what the defendant had said, that he was the one who brought BH into the conversation.
What do we make of the, following up on the Chief Justice's question, of the attenuation argument? Looking at page 129A of the transcript, when the questioning stops and the defendant is alone and the videotape continues to run and he's just talking to himself, and he says, then I'm only saying these things because, yeah, Bonnie told me to. Isn't that direct evidence that the prior day's interrogation is now polluting the second day's interrogation?
No, Your Honor, I would argue that at that point, the defendant, when you look to his statement over that she had offered him $5,000 to make the confession, that it was obvious that the defendant had no idea that he had been recorded the day before or that the BH had been in the company of police officers at that time. And so the defendant...
He could have been rehearsing an explanation that he was going to give that had to do with this bribery theory.
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah.
There could be a lot of possibilities for that statement. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. I would agree that he was positing scenarios in which he would be able to remove himself from the situation at that point in time, and that was one of the things that he said. And when the evidence that he presented of Bonnie presenting him with a $5,000 bribe to confess shows, I think, how very little effect whatever conversations he and Bonnie had the day before had on his confession the second day. When you look at his trial testimony, he said that he testified that it is, as the appellate division did, the appellate division noted that he didn't even raise the idea of threats until the during his, that he just went along to get along. And so I would argue that there's very little evidence to substantiate that the threats induced him to confess.
Any other questions for counsel? Ms. Ager, is there anything you'd like to add?
Just that the confessions were properly admitted, Your Honor, and thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Dominguez.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm just going to expand briefly on the law enforcement's role in the consensual intercept and our position that the police did not commit any misconduct in the consensual intercept or in the subsequent interview the following day. Here, we know that the detective testified that he instructed the mother that she could be deceptive and to engage defendant as much as possible, but they did not specifically instruct her to make any threats. And that was ultimately the mother's chosen line. Her questions were her own. She was not, there was no script in this case. We note that the mother testified that she was in the zone during the conversation, was not even paying attention to the detectives. And it's our position as the state, in agreement with the state, that the comments here did not cross the line to either render defendant's confession involuntary or warrant some form of intervention by the detectives during the consensual intercept.
She even mentioned movies, right? Correct?
Right.
As a source of her interrogation techniques.
Right. So she did acknowledge that that's why she ended up going, you know, with the DNA evidence, suggesting that there had been some fabricating that, but it wasn't the detectives. They told her she could be deceptive, but they never instructed her to threaten defendant.
So take that as a given, that they didn't instruct her to threaten. They are listening in real time, and you've heard some of the excerpts quoted. Assuming that one or more are threats, just assume it for the sake of the question. Does the law enforcement officer who is listening in have any obligation to pass a note or to suggest, don't follow this line of questioning, the physical threatening? Or can he just sit there having outsourced his responsibility to the civilian?
Well, with regards to this case, I don't think the comments crossed the line to warrant intervention. These cases are going to ultimately fall on the facts of each case. So if there's a time when the comments in a consensual intercept may cross the line, may present a possible question as to the voluntariness of the statements, and then there's a mechanism by which to do so, passing a note, just trying to direct the conversation in a different direction, certainly that would not hurt to avoid having to litigate this issue if it does cross the line. But in this case,
I may be wrong. I can't find it. At some point, didn't she say that she wasn't going to listen to the police because she went in a zone and this was her own idea from the movies and she wasn't going to listen to the police? I can't find it, but I could have sworn I read that at some point.
Yeah, so she did testify that she was in the zone and she was not paying attention to the police officer. So in this case, even if, the detectives were in the same room as her, of course, when this interception was going on, even if they had passed a note, it's unlikely that would have made any difference. Here, BH had the questions that she wanted to ask him. This was her first opportunity to speak with the defendant since the allegations had been brought to light. And so she was asking what she wanted to, and it's our position that the comments simply did not either overbear his will or warrant any type of intervention, and in this case they're unlikely that there would have been any difference had the detectives passed her note or anything like that. So, and I also would like to highlight that the defendant's responses are also key in the analysis because, you know, as Justice Lebecki has pointed out, we have comments, you know, in response to what should I tell Joe, defendant saying, I don't know, that's between you and him. Clearly, that would have been an opportunity if he was concerned about anything that she could have told her husband, that would have been an opportunity to say that. And he never, in fact, reveals in his responses any concern as to any of the comments regarding the husband and his possible reactions. And again, ultimately, as the state has noted, that there are these comments are really just predictions as to what someone else might do. And they didn't amount to stripping defendant of his capacity for self-determination. And again, that as to the second statement,
aren't all threats prediction? Aren't most threats predictions? If you don't do this, this is what I'm going to do to you. That's a prediction, but that's also, or can be, a real threat. No.
Yes, but in this case, we have a prediction as to what someone else might do. She's not suggesting that she's going to do something. It's that
there's nothing anywhere in this record that has that kind of language. Is there in this record?
Right. That's true, Your Honor. In addition, for the second statement, we know that the officers Mirandized defendant, that he said, I want to talk about this, and that none of the comments that the officers made amount to anything similar to LH, where the officers were promising leniency, where they were minimizing the defendant's actions. It's simply different. This was a 50-minute interview. Defendant suggested that he wanted to talk and did, in fact, confess in this case. And it's entirely different. We know that the defendant was unaware that the detectives had heard the earlier statement, and that's why he fabricated the bribery allegation against the mom, because he was unaware of that the detectives had listened to the first statement. And I also would just want to reiterate my last point, the standard of review here. So the deference this court has held.
Before you get to that, would you agree that if the police directly link the two statements in the manner in which they conduct the interview, the attenuation argument is a very weak one?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I would also note, as the state has, that the link was created by a defendant. He was the one who first said that he had spoken with the mother yesterday. It wasn't the detective. I mean, of course, the defendant was unaware that they had heard, so he was the one who first said, I spoke with BH yesterday, and he was the one who created, first brought that fact out. So I don't think it necessarily affects the attenuation argument. I still think...
I thought the whole notion about attenuation was that with the passage of time or perhaps intervening events, whatever problem there was with the first, the taint is now dissipated. So how can that be the case if the police directly bring that prior interview into the second interview? I just don't understand. To me, it seems like you're either going to win it all or you're going to lose it all. I don't understand the attenuation argument in light of the conversation the police had with the defendant. Help me.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree that if the first statement is ultimately found to be problematic, that it would taint the second one. We have a significant break in time. We have adequate warning of his rights. He was Mirandized. He started the interview saying that he wanted to talk about this. There's a change in place. And as to the first, as to that particular comment, if you made your peace with the mom yesterday, that's the only comment regarding the earlier consensual intercept, and that was after defendant said that he had spoken with her, but he doesn't elaborate as to what he told her or that he confessed. Ultimately, he made a separate, entirely separate statement to the police officers, not knowing that they had heard anything that had happened during the consensual interception.
Standard of review.
Yes, just briefly, Your Honors. As this court recently held in SS, that deference is afforded even if the factual findings are made based solely on a review of the video recordings. And here is our position that the trial court's factual findings as to the voluntariness were supported by sufficient credible evidence by just reviewing the two recorded statements here.
But the part I stand is the voluntariness has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt by the state. Am I correct about that?
Yes.
Thank you.
And we would just ask that this court affirm the appellate division's decision in this case.
Thank you. Mr. Hunter, rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have to unmute. Unmute.
Oh, am I unmuted?
Now you
can. Oh, okay. Thank you. So there's been a lot of debate about what Bonnie meant about with these statements, were they a threat or not? And I'd really like to point the court's attention to her testimony at trial. It's transcript 80, page 92. She's being cross-examined by a defense attorney. And this is on page 92, line 10. This is the defense attorney. There were a few times that it's fair to say that you threatened that Joe would come over to his house. And then here's Bonnie's answer. That's if I would have told Joe the truth. Joe still doesn't know the truth to this day. And then here's the next question. But you remember threatening that Joe would wind up in jail for beating Brian, correct? Answer, yes. And that's if Brian didn't tell me. All I wanted to know was the truth, so I could get my kids help. So, I mean, under the totality of the circumstances, Bonnie herself is telling us exactly what she meant, that she was.
Hunter, shouldn't we be going off of the actual conversation and not someone's interpretation of it afterward and determine whether it's threatening or not, whether the will was overborne based on what she actually said in her consensual conversation? Right.
But under the totality of circumstances, this is that person telling us what exactly she was doing. It's not somebody else's testimony. This is Bonnie's testimony herself telling us exactly what she was doing.
Isn't what
and if Bonnie and if Bonnie said the opposite, you would tell us to disregard it, correct?
Well, I mean, it would be part of the argument. I don't think I'd be here if Bonnie said the opposite.
No. If Bonnie in her answer on cross-examination gave a very different statement, you'd say, look at what actually happened. Make your determination based on the totality of the circumstances in the moment. Right?
Right. I agree with what you're saying, Chief Justice. I mean, it's based on what a reasonable person on the record. But all I'm just adding, there seems to be some dispute about it, though. My position is I think it's absolutely clear. And what I'm doing here is just adding in that, by the way, Bonnie agrees with me, and she's telling us exactly what she was doing, that she would have only told Joe if he didn't, if she didn't get the truth from Brian, and that's why she was, so that's the threat, and that's the whole reason she was doing it, because Brian was not telling the truth in her opinion. So, I mean, I don't know, I think that's something the court can consider, especially because the state, by the way, is also pulling in stuff from the trial that was said into their arguments. The only other thing I like to say is I just like to respond to the Burlington County prosecutor's argument that the defendant could have easily just ended the phone call, but that would have resulted in the threat being carried out. So that's the whole point, that he couldn't just end the phone call because he was being threatened that if you don't tell me the truth, which is, in her mind, admitting to the crimes, that I'm going to go tell this person to beat you up. So,
but part of the context of that is, isn't it fair to say, is he seeking her out? Now, he may have been worried. I think Justice Pierre-Louis noted that he was texting during this sort of critical period. For whatever the state of his knowledge was, he's alarmed. And he has some level of awareness that he he is in some peril here. So he's seeking her out. This is not her cold calling him and trying to get some information out of him. He's seeking her out for whatever his reasons are, to be reassured that he's not a suspect, get more information on what's happening, whatever his reasons are, and she engages him. So the idea that he can't escape from a conversation that he initiated without confessing, it's got a little context to it that doesn't quite support that. Wouldn't you agree?
No, I would. Respectfully, I don't agree with that at all. And because another big part of the context is that the police are recording it, and Bonnie has specific instructions to try to get a confession. So she's purposely. Why is she talking to the defendant? It's because she's trying to get a confession.
It's obvious, of course, that's absolutely clear. And that's not. But my point is that you're suggesting that the defendant's in a conversation he can't escape from without a confession. He has no way out of this conversation without confessing. He started this conversation. He initiated the contact that resulted in this conversation. So it's a bit less coercive than if he had been sitting at home, unaware that he had any involvement with his family, and suddenly gets a call from out of the blue from her. A little bit different context.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I mean, the defendant did not know that he was going to be threatened when he talked to her. So it's not so. And again, and the threat is exactly that. If you hang up the phone and don't talk, if you don't confess, I'm going to go have this physical violence happen against you. So the defendant, definitely a reasonable person would respond, would not feel like they could just hang up the phone, because they're feeling threatened that if that happens, that's exactly what's going to enact the physical violence against them. I don't, your Chief Justice, I don't have any other further comments unless there's any other questions.
No additional questions. Just we need help from counsel, both Mr. Hunter and Ms. Ager, on the questions that we've talked about.
Right.
What does the record reveal to us? What does the record reveal to us on whether defendant moved to suppress the first statement or both the first statement and the second statement? And second, if defendant only moved to suppress the second statement, what's the significance of that for us today? And please speak with the clerk of the court after the argument so that you can iron out timing with her. Thank you to all counsel for the helpful arguments. We will take